So, this is one of my favorite topics I want to talk about tonight. And it's again more of a practice talk and how we, not just in practice in life, but as we look at the balancing act of practice, I want to talk about the balancing of two particular aspects. And I'll get to them as I continue with the talk. So they are a couple of the five, they're called the spiritual faculties, indriya, spiritual faculties, the abilities that we have, aspects of our ability as we practice. And there are five, two pairs and a single one. And they're often actually, you can either, and both, view them, get to know them in a progression, the same way as one can with the factors of awakening, the seven factors of awakening, which one leads to the next, to the next, to the next. Or you can, and you can balance the two pairs and work at seeing, are they balanced? And that's just another way of just a check. For those who like templates, which I do, are kind of like, okay, any hindrances around? Let's just check them off and see. Or how are the factors of awakening doing? Just check them off and see. So it's the same kind of use, but it's a very useful reference because it's the kind of we're needing to know how we are, how is our energy, what's going on, and this is a way of doing it. So they are these five spiritual factors. Faith, wisdom, energy, concentration, and mindfulness. Mindfulness, as when looking at the balancing of the seven factors are the three energizing and the three steadying factors. The three energizing being interest, enthusiasm, delight, and the three calming being calm or tranquility, pasadi, concentration, samadhi, and equanimity, upekkha. They can be subsumed when one's just checking energy or calm. Well, very interestingly, two of the pairs in this little setup are energy and enthusiasm, virya, and concentration, steadiness, calm. So it's like taking the seven factors and squishing them into two opposing balancing pieces, which can be inflated, and we can go through them more subtly and step by step in the seven factors, but we can actually just like simplify them down into energy and calm. And sometimes when we're very calm, we need a little more energy. Sometimes when we're very energetic, we need a little more calm and concentration. So they adjust themselves together. So that's all I'm going to say about that particular pairing in the five spiritual faculties. It's a very handy way of, and this is what I've been talking about, what we have been saying several times over this retreat, way of just getting to know how is my energy, how are things going now, when does there need to be some letting go, relaxing, calming? When does there need to be some interest, curiosity, energizing? Itching, itching. The balancing factor, the thing that allows balance to happen is the mindfulness one. When there isn't mindfulness, we are in one of those things and there's no adjusting possible because we're caught in one and then we're sort of stuck there. With mindfulness, we can make the choice. It allows the faculties to be actually useful. So I won't say more about mindfulness. It's the beginning and ending of everything in waking up. So what I am going to talk about is these two of faith and wisdom. First of all, what I mean by wisdom, and what the word is panya, P-A-N-N-A, with a little whatever that is called over the top.
An enya.
Thank you. An enya over the N, making it a nya. Very good. That's a good word. Panya. And there, just to say, a way of understanding wisdom. Wisdom actually is a fruit. Wisdom comes with experience, with time, with understanding. You can't get it. You can't manufacture it. You can't even learn it. What we do is we are exposed to information, data, facts, stuff, stories, and people, and that's knowledge. And first of all, it's just facts. And then when we kind of work with it and absorb it and integrate it somewhat in our lives, it becomes knowledge. So we say, you know, we have a sort of body of knowledge, a certain level of understanding. When that becomes sufficiently integrated into our system, one of my latest favorite words for a person, into the system, then the system behaves in a way that is driven by or informed by this understanding, which is now deep in us. It isn't a knowledge that we have to sort of think of and remember and recite, or it becomes integrated into the system. And so our responses will be then led by our level of understanding, which is wisdom. And the more understanding we have, the wiser we are. So wisdom is the result of integration of knowledge. That's at least how I use the word, what I mean by that. When we don't have enough information, our system wants wisdom, wants to know more. It asks questions. What does this mean? You know, what do you mean by that? And that's a lot of what the explanation aspect of Dharma talks is about, is explaining, explication, how these words, you know, what they mean, how we experience them. But that's all theory. Real wisdom comes from inner experience. But we won't get that experience off. Well, sometimes we just fall into the inner experience, but a lot of times, because particularly with our overemphasized frontal lobes and all, we want the information. You know, we're interested. That's why you're all sitting looking at me like this right now, because of this hunger for knowledge. As that gets developed, so it becomes wisdom, as I said. We can overemphasize the wisdom, and some people are overemphasized when it comes to information. That's their whole area of interest, and that's their whole way of being, and they just want more and more information. And some of them, and there are people, of course, who just read book after book after book and can quote, and they're full of facts and stuff. But if it isn't integrated in their experience and in the Dharma by practicing, then it's just knowledge, endless knowledge. So there needs to be practice for it to go from knowledge to wisdom, for it to become our experience, our understanding in our guts, not our understanding in our heads, to shift from concept to reality for us. Now faith, sadha, S-A-D-D-H-A. Faith. This actually is in the introduction of this as a subject is considered first, because without a certain amount of faith that change is even possible, that release is an accessible thing, that there was such a brilliant teacher who actually did realize something that is possible for humans to realize, and some degree of faith, we won't even get started. It doesn't even begin. So we need some knowledge in order to get some faith, in order to get started in practice, in order to then get the knowledge to become more like wisdom. So they all depend on each other. I personally don't particularly resonate with the word faith, although lots of people do. Partly because I'm not a very trusting person, at least as a young person. I was pretty skeptical. I didn't have reason to trust people particularly. And so when there is a sense of faith, There's an openness in the spirit. There is a willingness to be at least even interested. There's like giving the person half a chance that what they're saying may be actually valid. With none of that, with no faith and no trust, and a lot of skepticism, I speak from experience, I'm learning something new, especially something important, like a spiritual something or other, and I can get quite hung up in skepticism, and I like they have to really prove themselves. Like, I don't assume they're right. I assume they're not, and they have to completely convince me, in spite of whatever ways I can try and pull apart their argument, that actually it's reliable. So that's the opposite of faith, skepticism. But sooner or later, somehow or another, when we have sufficient trust that this is doable and this is worthwhile, it's like the motor that can get us going. Like, we need some oomph. And there are times as we go through our lives and as we go through our practice that we run out of that oomph and we need to reconnect with something that inspires us to give us faith, which is why, for instance, at the beginning of a practice period, which you can take to be a 5-minute practice period or a 5-month practice period or a retreat or a sitting down for your daily half hour or whatever, refuges. Because when we take refuges, that is what actually, that's what it's meaning. Can you trust that this is doable and worthwhile and helpful? And when we have that trust, we then can proceed. So it's really, really a good idea. And at times in our lives when we feel like we're sort of grinding to a halt or it's getting a little unenthusiastic, it's actually something that's inspiring that brings faith. So whatever that might be for you. The thing about the refuges, in reflecting about this, the thing about the refuges that's so inspiring is the refuge of the Buddha is the possibility of a human to become transformed. The refuge in the Dharma is being able to trust things as they are. And the refuge in the Sangha is knowing perfectly well that we need to be encouraged by other people. So when you get you download your Dharma talk into your iPod and you turn it on, you are saying, I really have faith in the Sangha. Because without this iPod and this person to encourage me, I'm not going to be so here. The activity of reading books, of taking retreats, of listening to talks, and so on, is the activity of taking refuge in the Sangha. So we're all taking refuge in this period of time. There can be not very much wisdom from lack of experience, from lack of practice, from a lot of skepticism. Not very good sources of information, various things. And then there won't be faith. Who knows which comes first? A certain amount of faith must come before you even open yourself up to listening to something which then inspires you, which then gives you more faith, which then allows you to carry on. There can be wisdom without faith is you're just stuck being a scholar and no practice. There can be faith without wisdom, naivety, gullibility can be quite dangerous. You know, people can get led by the nose into all kinds of weird things, and that happens. So we need them both together. You can see how they need to be there for each other. When there is plenty of both faith, enthusiasm, confidence, trust, I like the words confidence and trust, they're my favorites for this, but they're all the same meanings. And there's understanding, and this makes sense, and the skeptical mind is somewhat satisfied that like, but what do you mean, has enough information, it's like a meal, that it can settle down and be quiet and you can actually get on with stuff, then it's possible to proceed. This reminds me of a thing that I used to say a lot when I was teaching prenatal classes to pregnant people, which I did for years and years. As I would say to them, particularly over that particular scenario that they were facing, this journey of mystery into a difficult, knowing they were going to be challenged by a lot of pain and come out most of the time in bliss. It was a weird thing, but they didn't know how on earth it was going to work and how they were going to do it. And so they had lots and lots of anxiety and no faith. And my job in the prenatal education was to give them information about how it just might be, so that this wondering, worrying, was, if I felt like I was giving them a big meal. But they still had to do the thing. They still didn't actually know how to do the thing. They just had information like lengths of time and, you know, some of other people's experiences and pictures of what the body does and this kind of information, so that their need for wisdom was satisfied. Then, I say, then your worrying mind goes to sleep. It's had a nice meal, so now it can lick its chops and go to sleep. And then it's out of the way, and now life can proceed without it, you know, especially in something as instinctive as that particular arena. So it's kind of like our need for knowledge is like a hunger, and so a certain amount of information satisfies that part of the mind. But it isn't just about knowledge. There has to be that sense of trust and confidence. It's the heart that's not the mind, so that we need both these so that we can proceed. What happens as we proceed and as we apply ourselves and we look and we train our minds and we calm down and we see, we begin to realize that the truth of what we're seeing is helpful. And we can see the places we get hung up, and we can see the places that we release, and we can see what is in the way of our being able to be vulnerable, and we see ourselves. We see the process of a human. It starts unraveling and re-exposing itself right in front of our very eyes, and we develop a confidence that the process is workable. And then we have increased faith. And faith becomes really big. Trust, we really can trust. And then there are times where we don't again. And then we do, of course, because nothing in any aspect of life is stable. It's always coming and going up and down. So where I want this talk to take us is into the area of when there is not faith. So we understand about knowledge and information and inspiration. But I want to actually go with you into the arena of when there is confidence and when there isn't. Of course, when the opposite of faith is doubt. So really, this is my favorite topic at the moment. And who'd have thought it? You know, like 6 months ago, my favorite topic is doubt. But it actually has become very interesting to me. So doubt, for those of you who like templates, is the odd man out in the five hindrances. The five states of being which stop the ability to relax and be free. The states of the ego, the states of being hung up, obstacles to freedom, which are wanting or resisting, restlessness, agitation, and dullness and thinking, and doubt. As a little reminder for those of you who like these kinds of things, you don't all have to remember all this, but restlessness is when the factors of awakening, the energizing ones, are too up, and dullness is when those concentrating, calming ones are too calm. They then become the hindrance, restlessness, or sloth and torpor. However, we're going to talk about doubt. Doubt is an absence of faith. Doubt is an absence of confidence. An absence of trust. Without any of that, without any confidence, we hold back. We don't know quite how to proceed. We only gingerly put our foot forward, but we don't put our full weight in it quite yet. We're not sure. It's a sticking. When there is confidence, on the other hand, we can boldly step out. We just go right ahead. Like if you know it's dark, the electricity has failed, but you know your house, it's nighttime, you know your house really well, you'll step with some confidence. If you're in a strange place and you can't see and it's dark, there'll be a lot of doubt that you might walk into the wall, or that that it's safe enough to proceed, and so you don't, if you're intelligent. You're not a complete fool. So the presence of doubt, the hindrance doubt, is the absence of the spiritual faculty, faith or trust. And what I want us to explore, and why I think it's so interesting, is just how much doubt manifests in us. Because it actually manifests a hell of a lot, and a lot more than I ever thought about. Initially, I thought, yes, I understand. When there's some doubt, then we feel a bit stuck. I understand that in theory. But I've been increasingly experiencing more and more nuances of doubt, and realizing that doubt is accompanying me a lot of the time. In very subtle ways. Actually, I don't have a lot of doubt. I have a lot of confidence in the Dharma and all, but I can see, I'll make sort of this big statement and then we'll unpack it a bit, that when there is a sense of me, the ego, there is doubt. And in those moments when there is no sense of self-consciousness or self-referencing, there is no doubt. Everything just is. And just is fine. But as soon as I get into any state at all where things aren't just fine, just the way they are, I've got to do something about it, haven't I? So, when something's happening that's unpleasant, it isn't just that it's unpleasant. It's unpleasant. That's simple. Lots of things are unpleasant. The next thing that happens is aversion, some form or another of resistance to the unpleasant. But when it's looked at closely, we can see it isn't just that I don't like it, it's that I don't trust it. Or I don't trust that it's okay for it to be here. I can just not like something and leave it at not liking, but I don't. I don't like it, and then it has to get rearranged. It has to be manipulated. It has to be avoided. It has to be all the things that Mark said when he talked about difficult emotions last week, those of you who were here. Sometimes we don't even want to admit that. We suppress the unpleasant whatever. Sometimes we blame somebody else. You know, sometimes we go into long explanations about where it came from and why it's there to kind of excuse ourselves for having it. Sometimes we get mad at ourselves for having it. Sometimes we are just afraid of getting overwhelmed by it. Sometimes we distract ourselves and we rush off to the phone and off to the fridge and all of the other things. All kinds, and there are many more than I've said. But the reason we're doing something with this feeling that we don't like is because there's a shadow, I believe, and I'm really wanting not to say that this is how it is. I want you to think of this as an exploration for yourself. Over time, see if this isn't true. It's because there's some degree of doubting that it'll be okay to be there. We're not able to trust it being there. It's intolerable. That's why the next step of doing something. Now let's take wanting something. When there's something that you really want, like not just that you would like, and that would be nice if I had it, okay, but when you really want something, when there's that like urgency or compulsion or something, when you look closely and see if trust is there, it's usually that I don't trust that I'm okay without this thing. Like there's something insufficient about life here that is too unreliable that I need to fill with this thing. It may not be a complete feeling of like being unsafe, that's a pretty overt version of it, but this isn't doable here without this thing that I need to now have. Which is why it drives us to have it. It isn't just that we like it or just that we want it, we need it. And what need means is I don't trust being without this thing that I have a need of. It won't be okay. It's not enough this moment. At least this is a way that I've been seeing trust and the doubt, and it's been interesting for me to explore this. Now let's take the next hindrance, squirminess, agitation, restlessness, worry. Almost always when we worry, which even can be as gentle and mild as a planning, it's because it isn't okay. We've got to fix it, haven't we? We've got to plan and arrange, or we can't stand it. When we sit there, if we're sitting in the hall in a meditation retreat and we have an attack of the squirmies, you know, it's like, I don't think I can stand this another minute. When the hell is he going to ring the bell? That's definitely a doubt that we are okay, a doubt that we can handle this. We really don't think we can. We want to anything. Give me anything to do. It's intolerable at times. I don't think that doubt is present with sloth and torpor a lot of the time, but some of the time it is, because there are times when we find ourselves going into a feeling of dullness, thinking mind, when we actually doubt we have the capacity to be with some unpleasant thing that we would have to experience if we weren't so sleepy. So there are times, not for everybody, but there are certainly recognizable, well-known times in meditation practice where sleepiness is an avoidance tactic. The system is not able because it's afraid. And part of fear is doubting we can handle it. That's why we're afraid of the thing. It isn't just plain fear. We are afraid that we will somehow drown, or we will somehow collapse, or we will somehow lose something, or lose control, or something. That's definitely doubt, isn't it? I'd say yes. So sometimes sloth and torpor has got doubt in it. And then, of course, the fifth hindrance is doubt. Well, I'd say, yeah. This came out of a retreat that I was, my last retreat, last November, December, when I was at Guy House, and I was the teacher there who I was checking in with, is Christina Feldman, who I've sat with before, as a lot of you know. And so I was exploring this. I don't know how it began. Probably a little flash of insight was like, God, you know, you're really doubting here. And I began to really allow myself to see if whenever there was doubt, which is why it got so fascinating, because there seemed to be so much of it, what I saw was when the mind was totally calm and quiet and the heart was completely relaxed and glad and trusting and fine, there were no I thoughts. And when there were I thoughts, I had to do something about something because I didn't trust it to leave it as it was. And I thought, you know, every time there's me showing up, it's because I doubt reality as it is. And it gets very subtle sometimes in there, but there are those little I thoughts, that person shouldn't be doing that. What do they think they're doing, moving around like that in the silent house? I don't trust that they're okay, that they're doing it right. I don't trust myself for being able to handle their disturbance. A lot of our judgments are actually, they've got flavors of this. Not totally, but see if this isn't, I just keep finding it showing up in the oddest places. And when I went to Christina and said, you know what? I just think that doubt is the actual cause of the ego. She just kind of nodded and grinned. And then she said, doubt's the biggie, she said. And Christina's given to few words. So I thought, that's significant. She said that. It's not talked about much. We talk about greed and hatred and delusion and various other aspects of it all. We don't actually talk a lot about doubt, and I think it's a very under-respected hindrance state that we can get into. So when there is a feeling that things aren't okay, things are not completely fine, just as they are, this is it. Here we are. This is what we've been waiting for. It's here. It's me. It's you. It's now. This is it. If there's any little, but then there's a little bit of doubt, I think. But maybe just a little bit more of anything at all. We aren't completely okay. And we don't trust ourselves, and we don't trust that we don't trust. That feeling of, I want a little bit, I need just some other something tweaking or some little bit less of this, then all the magic happens. Then I can stop, blah, blah, blah. Then I've reached my destination. We don't trust that, do we? Do you trust that this is enough? So out of this period of my practice, my first metta phrase, which had already been trusting goodness, became like really important. Like this was. So whenever I would be in my, you know, being what I was doing, when I started noticing these I thoughts coming in and allowed myself to feel that feeling that things aren't completely fine, what I would do would soothe that doubting being with trust. And I would say trusting. And then I would let myself, I just let myself think of anything that was, that I could trust. And, you know, it was trusting being in a place with safe people and friends who are all very wholesome and all trying to become even more beautiful. And as I mentioned the other day, the young man in the hallway across from me gave me such a sense of confidence and trust and goodness and inspiration, and the teachers and all those kinds of things, or trusting that actually I'm a decent person. If we go into blame, if we go into, you know, the unworthiness, it's super doubting ourselves. It's super doubting that this is efficient, that this is effective, that I have the capability to do this, that I have the energy for this. Doubt is just plaguing us. It diminishes us, it just punches holes in everything, we're leaking like crazy. It's harmful. It's a powerful force. It isn't just hesitation. It is hesitation, but it isn't just that. It's what Hafiz says, jealousy and almost all of your problems or sufferings, whatever he says, are from believing you know better than God, or you know better than the truth. Well, if you think you know better than the way it is, you don't trust the way it is, therefore you doubt. And as soon as you're in any one of those difficult states of anxiety or blame or fear or grief or anything, you're arguing with how it is. You are not trusting that it is as it is. And we do this all the time. We do this way more than we realize. That's why we struggle. And we want something to free us. And if we can abandon this feeling of doubt, and it's described that we actually abandon the hindrances. That's what we're practicing, abandoning hindrances. Everything's fine. Nothing changed except our attitude. We didn't have to rearrange anything. We just abandoned needing to rearrange anything. So my invitation for you is to, anytime something obvious is going on, where you feel a little hung up, see if this isn't true for you. Are you not trusting things to be as they are? And when you notice if that's the case, that's when the antidote of anything that we can trust. And in my case, I just think some kind of metta reassurance, gladdening the heart, is what soothes it, so it can say, I can be with this as it is. This is okay. It is doable. In all the various ways that we learn, all the various skills we learn, being just in this present moment, meet it just in the body, say to yourself, storytelling, picture TVs and couches, whatever, however it is you do it. Do the things you need to do to reassure yourself that actually I can just relax. Let things be as they are. Remember, open, curious, wonder, loving, If mnemonics work for you, use these little skills when you find yourself caught up to reassure yourself so we don't have to second guess what's happening. It's what's happening. And because doubt's in there with so many of the states we get into, we need different ways of being with those different kinds of states. It's not that we, you know, there isn't a sort of set formula to do every time, count to 10 and start again, because at times we need, you know, more expansiveness, at times we need to reflect on something, at times we need more metta, at times we need to sit back and just remember, oh yes, what is it that I love about, why am I here? What is it that I love about the practice? What is it that I do trust? Which is why, as some of I've told you, sometimes when if I'm going to give any kind of Dharma talk, when I sort of collect myself at the beginning, I'm just coming to a place of trust, of confidence. I'm attempting to abandon whatever hindrance might be in the way. The hindrance of doubt might be in the way, so that there's confidence that I can share with you. It's why when people are why devotion is such a precious, valuable thing for so many people. Because when we're devoted to something, we feel safe. We can trust that. That of all the people, of all the different religious practices in the world, I don't know where I read this, some atlas of modern something or other, 75% of religious practitioners are devotees of something. It's the favorite way of doing inner work. Because there isn't doubt. You actually can place your trust in somebody who will help you do it, or some devotional aspect. Vipassana is not particularly a devotional part. And so there are people in this tradition whose focus more is, you know, on understanding, or in practical terms, rather than there being a devotional element as there are in even the other Buddhisms, like certainly in Vajrayana and all of its, you know, idolatry and everything. Huge element of faith there. Not so in Vipassana so much. So this is an area that we need to take care of for ourselves in whatever way. So this wasn't one of those pre-prepared talks with all kinds of quotes at the appropriate time. Because I wasn't here while I was preparing this talk, I'd just been thinking about it. And so, I'm done. But I would be happy to have anybody ask me anything or say something that this might stimulate, because we can continue the discussion if we would like.
I always have doubting questions. A couple of things. One is, when you said that Vipassana isn't really a devotional practice, the other way is it really is a devotional practice. It's devoted to the Dharma, really. But that kind of leads me to my initial question was, at the beginning you said we take refuge in the Dharma and the Buddha and the Sangha. There's so much doubt at this point. Do you think we really need to see how much of faith do we need before we have trust? You know, because I oftentimes people ask you, why do you do this practice? There must be some faith at some point, and faith is such a dirty word in our culture now, you know, because it implies blind faith. And I always say, well, no, I didn't really have any faith. I just sort of stumbled into this practice, and it's based on your experience. So you don't really need faith. You just need experience. But what you're telling me initially was, no, no, you do need faith to get the experience. And I don't see, can't you just, even if you didn't believe that there was a real Buddha and, you know, any of that stuff, just on your own experience, would you need that faith?
I'm going to see if I can repeat that question. Really, Dave's asking, is it necessary to have faith as the first as the initial impulse. And he's doubting that you need faith. Because he's saying, like, what about if you just stumble upon it and then your own experience reveals to you what is so that gives you the confidence to proceed, which is your experience, which is mine also. So just because they list it as number one in the five spiritual faculties, if you have an argument between the bird and the field guide, trust the bird. Trust what actually is so, and don't worry about who says it should or shouldn't be. Shoulding is always when there's doubt. Like, should this, or I should this, or I really should. It, how it is isn't enough, isn't okay, and so there should be something better or different. Or so that's what you're exhibiting beautifully for us. That's what doubt feels like. It's like, but it's a hang up. It's like, well, shouldn't it be some other way? Or I don't know if this is so. And that's exactly, that feeling is the thing to be conscious of. And that feeling is a stuck with, you know, it's like, oh, but I'm not sure if this is okay. If I hadn't heard this talk and wasn't thinking about this, I'd just carry on, do my practice, and things would unfold.
Plus, now that you, when you doubt this, you have a lot of ego because you think you know the answer anyway. So whenever you have that doubt, you have all that ego.
To me, doubt brings the ego up. Because as soon as there's doubt, there is like, maybe I need to do something differently, or maybe what I've done isn't okay, or... So then it's like the doer, the meditator, the one who wants to be the perfect one suddenly is there. When there isn't any of that doubt, there's just, it just is, and the ego can just disappear. So I'm not trying to make you be doubtful. I'm trying to have you recognize how often it's actually in the way.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes, but is that a satisfactory answer for what comes first?
So what you're saying is it doesn't really matter which comes first. It's chicken or the egg.
That's right. Chicken, egg.
Which is part of my next question, which is probably a chicken and egg question. But when you said that when there's the ego, there is doubt, right? Don't you think at some point you're doubting the existence of itself anyway? In some sense, maybe the ego kind of creates doubt, and doubt creates an ego.
I think they are one and the same. At least that's what I'm exploring these days. When there is ego consciousness, identification, there is doubting mind. At least that's, I'm not saying that is how it is, and I'm not, this is not what the Buddha said explicitly in that way, but I think it's a really rife area to explore. And I don't know if because there's a state of ego, there is then doubt, or if as soon as we're in doubt, there comes the ego, or if they're the same thing that come. And play with it, and it doesn't actually matter.
No, but because it would be, and there's nothing really there anyway.
That's right.
So it would just be this tension.
Yes, that's what it is. Right. When there's dukkha, there is tension. When there is liberation, there is no tension. There is no dukkha.
Doubt.
Doubt's one big piece of it, for sure. We'll see how big in your own experience, but I think it's pretty big. But don't, as I said, don't. This isn't so that you can manufacture more of it. David. The Davids and their skeptical question. No, do you think?
It seems to me developmentally that unsafe is doubt. It turns into doubt. It turns into ego.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's not tolerable, it's not safe, I can't be here, I doubt. I shift into a reality that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then behave outside of relationships.
Mm-hmm. Not in harmony with things as they are, in argument with things as they are, because not safe, not trusting, it isn't okay like this, intolerable, that's right. And it's just Yeah. The thing about these hindrances, the instruction is they are to be abandoned. But as I put on the board last night, that has his poem, the one about thirsty, damned thirsty, is until we see them, they won't be abandoned. They are alive and well in our unconscious. And they are our extended family, as I've said before, because they're like around a lot of the time, like families, like we don't necessarily want them to be there, but they are actually attached to us, and it's the way it is. So the way of abandonment of anything in all of this practice is first to know and to allow, to let be, and experience the implications, and experience the impact, and experience the burden, and the pressure, and the tension of any of these aspects of the hindrances, i.e. the ego. And the more we allow ourselves to be able to be with them, the more ludicrous or exhausting or struggly they are recognized as being, and then the less they will be identified with. It's through their pain that they become less compelling. But when we don't realize how unpleasant it is to be in a state of needing something, we're so busy looking at the thing, we're not appreciating that we're in a state that's so imbalanced that we, of course, don't realize, so we keep looking at the thing. We feel the struggle of any of these states over and over. Like, who wants to do that? But we don't notice that part. We notice the objects of our world rather than our response and reaction.
In the faith part, I think I stumbled also into it, and I think many people did, into the practice. And I think one of the things that happens of why people do that, it's sort of a faith thing they don't realize, is that people experience, although not well articulated, but they experience the first noble truth that even if we have really good lives, with really good families and everything, there's still something not right. And then we might do some sitting practice and then notice how really things aren't very right in our minds. And then I think many people in the world sort of have an unarticulated knowledge of the first noble truth.
Yeah. I've heard Ajahn Sumedho say that in the Asian countries where Theravadin is, you know, the part of the culture, the motivation for practice is faith. And in the Western culture, the motivation is a generalization, is dukkha, just as you've said. And so, or doubt. So actually, in that case, which I think is commonly true, which is certainly true for me, it isn't so much faith, it's hope. You know, there's got to be a better way. Let's see if this one will fix things. Because this is obviously not enough by itself, so I hope this will actually be helpful. And there's some glimmer of anticipation, you know, mini faith that this is, like when I told you that story of my heavenly messenger experience with my friend Barry, who said when I was complaining about my husband and that marrying him hadn't made it fantastic for some reason, it was still okay, but the same. And he said, have you ever thought it might be you? And I was like, you know, when I told you that, I was completely almost out of breath with the realization that it was an inner reality that I was projecting. I've never even crossed my mind that that even was a possibility. And I took myself in a very short period of time, like an hour or something, to the local newly opened spiritual bookshop, Banyan Bookshop, with some thread of hope. Because I wasn't okay, and it wasn't okay, and somehow things weren't working as I thought they should. And I had some ray of, there's got to be something here. Even though when I went into the bookshop and I couldn't even pronounce any of the titles, because they were all weird Indian names and Sanskrit this and that and Russians and who knows who, you know, Uspensky, all this stuff. I had no clue. I still had hope. There's got to be something here. Spiritual, this must be something. and went home with a Tassajara bread book, which I couldn't pronounce. But made good bread, you know. That was my first piece of confidence. Little experience of bread actually works if you do it with a little consciousness. And so began my first bit of faith. So it goes. So it's a mini step, but nothing is as big as we think. So don't think, okay, there's got to be faith first or before. It's a little of this and a little of this, and they're all just the ingredients that all lead onward.
Wasn't there also some doubt?
Absolutely. Plenty.
Things are not right.
Absolutely. It wasn't okay. I doubted marriage. I thought marriage was the be-all and end-all, and it turned out that it let me down. And so then I was back thrust into doubt of what is this all about, back into the existential angst of, which I think is also majorly doubt. It's not enough. Somehow I was sold a bill of goods. I don't know what that means. I know what it's supposed to mean, but it doesn't make sense. Abandoning the hindrances doesn't directly translate into got rid of. It means getting to know well and understand their value or not. Be careful, it isn't one more aversion. Let yourself play with this state and know it, get to understand it, when it is there, when it's part of your experience, how it feels. Which is why, even though it sounded weird, I'm saying it's one of my favorite areas of exploration, because it's very helpful for me to understand where I get struggly, where I am hung up, where I arise. I want to know where I arise. I don't want to try, I'm not trying to get rid of anything. I'm trying to see what hangs me up, what releases me, how does it work. It's fascinating. It's helpful. So anyway, I hope this has been helpful. Thank you for your attention. I'll ring the gong because it's so nice.